This is James.
David Shea.
Hi, David. It's James.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes,
Paula?
Hi, Paula.
Hi. This is
Hi, it's James and David.
Hey, James and David.
Hello again. Back from the gold fields.
That's right.
Yes. Are we going to have the easy questions this week?
I hope so. We're a little bit early, so if you're not ready, that's okay. But otherwise, we can get started.
No, I'm
sure.
Ready.
Yes.
Okay. Give me an empty space here, so we can start the edit, and then I'll do the introductions again.
So you're recording our voices, basically, right? You're not
yes.
typing as we talk.
That's correct.
Great.
All right. Good afternoon. I'm James Hallebuck from the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia, and I'd like to welcome you to today's Object of History Forum. Object of History is a joint project between the Center for History and New Media and the Smithsonian National Museum of American History to provide students and teachers around the country with a look at key objects from the collection. Our focus today is the gold nugget found in California in 1848. This will be the second of two forums about the gold nugget. And we'll be talking about that nugget with David Shate, an associate curator at the National Museum of American History. He works in the Division of Work and Industry. And Paula Petrick, professor of history at George Mason University. Among other things, she works on issues surrounding the American West. Thank you, David and Paula, and thank you, callers.
Greetings.
Hello.
Hi. Our first question today is from Stephen, curiously, from Virginia. He wants to know whether the romanticization of the West was created by gold fever, or is this phenomenon older than that? And I guess we'll start with Paula.
Oh, gee, a cultural history question. It's not clear to me in terms of when the questioner asks about romanticization of the West. There's a lot to romanticization of the West and how various parts of it have been romanticized. I'm not sure. I can't think of any sort of cultural artifacts about the romanticized, probably early movies, of the gold strikes. I can think of movies where it was not romanticized. For example, McCabe and Mrs. Miller. But I would imagine that gold strikes of this nature have always loomed large in the public imagination and have led to a variety of different kinds of books. The basic genre of buried treasure, pirate loot and whatnot, the lost Dutchman mine appears over and over again in literature. And although it may not be gold, certainly novels such as King Solomon's Mines have romanticized the finding of great wealth and whatnot. I don't know, David. What do you think about that?
Well, I've been thinking as you talk, but could you repeat the question, James?
Sure. Stephen wants to know, essentially, whether the gold rush itself created the romanticization of the West, or does it go further back than that? Is there a notion that the West is this adventurous, romantic place prior to the gold rush?
So he's asking whether there was a romanticized West before 1848 or 49.
Yes, I think so.
I'm getting some feedback. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you, but I hear the feedback as well, too.
There's some funny clicking going on.
There's a little bit of a, I guess,
okay.
Feedback. I'm not sure.
Okay, well, I'll continue on.
That's a little better.
Right. Well, as Paula said, the search for wealth and riches is age-old. It's from antiquity and probably earlier, the idea of the fascination with distant wealth. But from what James seems to be asking, he's saying, is there a prior romanticized West before the gold rush? And I was thinking that perhaps the Lewis and Clark expedition of the first decade of the 19th century helped put in the American mind the idea that there was a West far away over on the Western Ocean that was full of unknowns, full of unknown peoples and resources and, of course, wealth. But the whole idea of the West, it really is also a question of where is the West? There was quite a long time when the West was regarded as over the mountains from the East Coast, mm-hmm. In the area of the Mississippi River Valley, the Ohio Valley. So the West is pushed further and further westward as the country expands, and of course as methods of communication improve, getting word back in various forms to the people in the East that there was a West and what it might contain, of course, peoples, resources, and ultimately this notion of vast treasure for everyone.
Okay, very good. Well, in our last forum, the issue of globalization came up, and we talked specifically about a couple of ethnic groups that joined in the gold rush. Can you hear me there, David?
Yes.
Okay. Well, we have a follow-up question, I think, from Maureen in Montana, who wants to know specifically about the Chinese and whether they experienced, first of all, whether they experienced any prejudice in California, and then second, whether that affected the number of Chinese who came to the West. So,
well,
David, can we start with you?
Okay, sure. Certainly the answer is yes, they experienced prejudice in the West. I think that's kind of a no-brainer. An exotic people, certainly a minority at the time, experienced all kinds of prejudice, occupational, personal, certainly things having to do with their family, the act of immigration itself, a tough thing to begin with, but then to confront people in search of their own personal wealth, expose them to all kinds of suspicion and misuse. How that got translated back to China and to other parts of Asia, clearly through family connections, but also the shipping lanes and the movement of peoples on board ship. The word did get back. Is that really what she's asking about?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah, that's really
Whether we have any notion of specific notion of whether Chinese come in lower numbers as a result of it was word of mouth, or whether there are travel narratives or something like that.
There's a long history, but I think it goes without saying that the immigration was not discouraged by prejudice or the perception mm-hmm. of prejudice. The record indicates a continuing and increasing wave of Asian immigration to the West Coast. Prejudice in and of itself is not an off-putting experience, I don't believe, for immigrants. It's something they hope not to find and cope with, but I can't be any more specific than that.
Sure. Paula, did you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I think it's a very difficult question, basically because the number of documents that we have left on the Chinese side, and they present certainly very, very difficult search challenges. For example, you have to be able to read another language, and the number of revolutions that have swept through China have destroyed a great many of these documents. And so to answer that question, we would have to dig very, very deep and have an array of research skills that would certainly challenge most historians.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. Well, hopefully we've gotten the really, really tough questions out of the way here. This one, we'll start with Paula, because I know that you've done some work with children before in the history of children. And Lee from Virginia would like to know whether we have an idea or a sense of how many children came to California during the rush, presumably along with one or more parents.
Well, we don't know how many children came. We don't know how many children traversed, made a great journey in any given time period. But because the hunt for mineral wealth usually attracted young men, the number of children who went to the various mining bonanzas was relatively low initially. But as soon as people began mining the miners, people wanted to bring their families with them. And so quite quickly you have children arriving and playing in the mining works. There's a wonderful document that I've run across, which describes a little girl growing up. It's a reminiscence of her mother, and she's totally fearless. She climbs all over the mining ditches and a place where children could really drown. and traipses all over the place with her dog, and has just an incredibly wonderful time. But as to exact numbers, very, very difficult.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jim,
I get a terrible feedback.
I think we're both
getting it as well.
We're both getting it.
Our engineer has informed me that he hears it just fine. So it's recording just fine. I don't know what to do in the meantime about what we're hearing, because I hear it as well.
As Paula was talking, I just was thinking about the whole idea of childhood, that the Gold Rush itself gave adult men especially a chance to sort of relive a childhood experience of digging in the dirt, sitting on the ground, making mud, breaking through rocks. It's certainly nothing that required a college degree, and it would allow people without much of an education to somehow play and get rich at the same time.
All right.
There
that's an interesting perspective as well.
A little psychobabble for you there.
Okay, well, Brett from Ohio asked a question about travel by water. To set this up, I think we have a notion of individuals or families making the trek to California overland. And so Brett would like to know about how many people, either by number or by percentages, about how many of those people came to California by ship. David, would you want to start with that?
Well, I can't give you exact numbers, but there was a large percentage that came around the Horn and also overland through Panama. Today we are aware of the Panama Canal, which permits ships and nearby trains to transit the Panamanian Isthmus. But at the time of the Gold Rush and before that, if you wanted to get to California or back, you had choices of taking a sailing ship down way around South America through the Straits of Magellan, very hazardous, long, risky trip, or somehow get off in Colombia, which was then what we call Panama today, and hire a mule team or horses to get you across the isthmus, through the jungles, across rivers, and great pestilence. And it was quite a immigration trail. Churches were set up to save the souls of those who dared make that trek. And then at the other side, on the Pacific side, you would have to hire out a ship, find a ship that had room, get on board, and make the trek up the coast by water. Numbers are formidable in both cases, but I'm not aware of any statistics in that regard.
Okay. Paula, is there anything you'd like to add for that?
No, once again, these statistics are very, very difficult to come by.
Well, that actually reminds me of another thought here. Paula, you mentioned a few minutes ago the idea that historians deal with evidence and with documents and recovering these stories through accounts. How many firsthand accounts do we actually have of participants in the Gold Rush, or is our notion based more on later interpretations or later voices?
Well, gee, in terms of absolute numbers, I have no idea, but based on what I've read about the Gold Rush, there seems to be a number of documents. I mean, statistically speaking, given the number of people who went, we can expect that a decent portion will have survived. The same is true of trips taken overland to Oregon.
James, before we continue, we're inside some kind of matrix
this is
here.
It's getting hard for me.
It's getting very hard for us to hear and speak. Suppose you could hang up and call us back. Would that help?
Let's go ahead and do that. I'll send a note to the engineer, and if you guys will just stay by the phone, we'll pick this up in a minute or two.
Stay on the phone?
Yeah. Well, no, hang it up, and I'll have him start over.
Okay.
Should we hang up? Hello?
This is James.
Hi, James.
Oh, much better.
Oh, much better.
All right, do we have David yet?
Hello?
David?
David?
Hello, yes, James, hi.
That should be much better. It's certainly better for me.
Yeah.
Sounds better.
Okay, good. Well, when we left off, we were talking about first-hand accounts or narratives from actual participants, and of course it's impossible probably to know exactly how many accounts that still exist today, but I'm curious about how much of our current knowledge, our current notions about the Gold Rush are based on those. Do we have a lot of accounts that survive?
Yes, by and large. And comparative to other historical events, there are quite a few, because men who went and women and families realized they were undertaking a monumental journey. And so they were very self-conscious about memorializing it. So they were much more likely to write long letters home, to keep a diary. Many of them made arrangements with local newspapers to send dispatches from the gold fields. And you see a lot of small town eastern newspapers which will from time to time have a dispatch from the gold fields of California. So I would say by and large there's a good deal of primary source first-hand accounts. There are also, of course, reminiscences, accounts of people looking back on that experience. And they tend to be, I think, a little less useful than the "you are here" or "I was there" type of account.
Yes, they can be colored and romanticized and sometimes tweaked in terms of facts and figures. The Smithsonian has recently acquired the papers, just to give an example of what Paul is talking about, the papers of a gold miner who did reasonably well with his brothers and then shifted into the manufacture of hydraulic mining equipment and water wheels. We have letters, a diary, a business journal, and some promotional ads that helped explain how he survived, not just as a gold miner, but later as a businessman. So the literature is very rich with first-hand accounts. Keep in mind that this is we're witnessing the dawn of the emergence of mass media, of newspapers that were available across the country, limited numbers, and also the rise of the U.S. Postal Service. So these two phenomenons were really pushed by and helped accelerate the spread of the gold rush, lore and fever. And there's a huge body of records, especially in California, for anyone willing to dig into primary sources.
Okay. If you're just joining us, we're talking with David Shate from the National Museum of American History and Paula Petrick from the George Mason University, two experts on history of the West, specifically on the Gold Rush. We have another question now from Marianne, and from Minnesota, actually. And it seems like Marianne has been doing some reading or some research on her own, because she asks whether it's true that some families tried to bring extravagant possessions, like pianos or other large objects, on the Overland Trail with them, only to have to abandon them at some point because they proved too cumbersome or for some other reason. Are these sort of stories true, or is this myth? David?
Well, I believe they're true. I do have heard accounts of people with extravagant aspirations of moving to the West and setting up home there at least for a year or two, carrying with them rocking chairs and all kinds of luggage. And whether apocryphal or not, Marianne might be onto something. She must have read or heard about furniture being left by the side of the trail as animals give out and as the load needs to be lightened, or perhaps burnt for firewood. Again, this is perhaps a little bit romanticized, but the idea of moving west with all of one's possessions did catch hold in some families. I've not seen any specific figures nor tabulations about the amount of furniture left along the trail. But clearly, any time there's a mass migration of this sort, this kind of thing occurs. Families were less common than others who sometimes would just leave the farm and head west, with perhaps a small bag on their back, or ship out on a whaler, not a whaler, a sailing ship, with not a whole lot more. Keep in mind all the outfitters that were located around San Francisco, ready to fit up a mining crew with most anything they needed and charge appropriately for it.
Paula, what's the strangest thing you've run across in your research?
Well, I think it's important here to differentiate between the people who went on the Overland Trail, who were primarily families and who were taking family treasures and whatnot, and the primarily single men who took off for the California and Nevada gold fields.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of the Overland Trail, yes, there were times when people had been given the wrong advice. For example, people who wanted to use horses rather than oxen, or second choice would be mules, on the trip, and then had to lighten their loads as the horses literally gave out.
Right.
I can't think of. I remember seeing one thing that struck me on the Oregon Trail when I was there one time was a chamber pot that had been cast aside, and I was thinking, why on earth would that have been a choice to be cast aside? But then that's just me wondering about such a thing.
well, I think
we can all
qualifies.
Speculate. Yes, yes.
Well, the next question wins the award, I think, from the caller who's farthest away. Diana from Hawaii wonders about, of course, we may not know hard numbers or actual numbers, but she wonders about how many people who came out to the West, whether for gold or for some other purpose, how many of them, once they proved unsuccessful or found out that it was harder to make a living mining gold than they thought it was, how many of those returned back home to the East? Do we have a sense that many people had to give up and return home, or are we talking about just a few people? I guess we could start with Paula on this.
I think the last figures I read were something between 70% and 80% returned home. It was the business, the mercantile people who sort of stayed on, literally, mm-hmm. who had brought their families. I mean, if you're broke and you're in the California gold fields, there's really nothing to stay for.
Right.
So you might as well get your stake together and get a ship going back, or return with a train that's heading east. We always forget about those wagon trains that were going the opposite direction.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a few, so you could sign on with those. Although I think the young men primarily preferred to take the sailing route.
Not uncommon, but it's actually perhaps the majority of miners actually end up doing that. David, you were getting ready to say something?
Well, yes, a little less unclear is the distinction between coming home with a good stake, with great wealth, and coming home with your tail between your legs, completely broke and barely able to get home, sad that you ever left, but full of great stories and high adventure in the West. So it really was a bit of a gymnastic act for them to think about on their way home. What am I going to tell mom and dad or sister? What am I going to tell my friends at the country store about what I did there? Am I going to make up a bunch of stories? Will I tell them the truth of what really happened, how I struck it rich and then lost it all gambling or got robbed? What am I really going to say? And that really teases out the fickle nature of the gold rush. It's a gold rush of the mind as well as the pocketbook, and how it affected people's lives after they returned home. How do they? Is that the climax of their whole life? How do they make another life out of them? Out of their ordinary surroundings.
Well, there was also making your way back home slowly, sort of moving from gold field to gold field as you made your way home, sort of picking up your grub stake as you went along. And maybe, just maybe, you got lucky and then you could settle down. Or you got enough to put together money for a farm on the Front Range in Colorado, and you decided to stay there and bring the family out to meet you.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I see. This idea is very complicated.
Right. It's not about just going out for a trip and coming back. There's a great deal more going on there.
All right. Well, thank you. I I would guess that Shannon, our next caller from Colorado, is probably an economist, or at least studying to be one.
Oh.
Because Shannon wants to know whether the discovery of gold, and therefore the insertion of this additional gold into the economy, makes whether it has any effect on the price of gold, whether the value dips in response to, you know, an influx in the amount, or whether it has zero effect at all in the economy. That's kind of a complicated question, but David, do you want to start with that?
Yes, and I'll say that this enlightened questioner is really pushing the boundaries of our ability to comprehend the true impact of that amount of gold dumped into the market. Gold clearly mattered. Gold matters today as a standard, but I'm not about to measure or state today what the impact was. I just can't. But thank you for trying.
Paula, do you have any thoughts on that, or should we leave that to Shannon
as
a research project?
I think it would be difficult to find out. But here's a little statistic. Okay, when the SS Central America sank off the Carolinas in 1859, it was estimated that between 1852 and 1855, 57, that the Central America had carried one-third of the total output from California. And I think that was estimated at like $200 million. So when you were thinking about the amount of gold dumped into the economy, if you multiply that times 3, we have, $600 million?
Still substantially less than a billion.
Still substantially less than a billion, and certainly not comparable to what the Central American gold mines, after the conquest, dumped into the European economy. So I'm thinking, just based on that and applying a little country logic, that the American economy, and certainly the global economy, was able to absorb that quite handily. Because we have to remember that in 1857 there was a depression. So to have that nice infusion of gold would have been very nice, but it would have been sucked up right away.
That's right.
And used to pay off European creditors. So I'm thinking that there was a kind of equilibrium, that the gold strikes were big, but not quite that big enough to rock the global economy. Now, I could be wrong on that, and what I'm doing is I'm just thinking, adding different bits and pieces here of information in order to come up with an estimate, a place to start.
Well, Shannon, if you're listening, that's a great place to start, and there's your senior thesis right there. Or more.
Right.
We next have a question from Sheena from Wisconsin, who I think is concerned about attitudes in the East. And she wonders about how American citizens in the East view this population boom. How do Easterners, do we have a sense, I guess, of how Easterners see this boom, and whether they look ahead to a time when California is going to become a state? Or are they... is California too far away and not really on their radar and don't think about it at all? David, we'll start with you on that.
She's asking about the population boom in California
and
its effects on New England and the East Coast.
Sure.
Well, I've not seen firsthand accounts for this, so I can only speculate. Paula may have more concrete evidence, but I do believe there was a sense that some of the best and brightest young men were leaving the town, leaving the village, leaving the city for the gold fields out in California, some ridiculous, foolhardy venture, and depriving towns of that economic benefit and their hard labor and their future wages and family upbringing. It was a little bit of a blasphemy for so many men to leave a given town, and there are certainly accounts of concerns about that. Long-term impact, hard to say. It was tempered by the hope that some of these men would come back with California gold and return wealth to the communities they left from. So it was a mixed message. Paula, any further evidence on that question?
But, yeah, that would be difficult. I'm getting I'm not sure I heard the question correctly. I was thinking that I heard economic boom, but you talked about a population boom.
Right.
I heard it correctly.
Yes.
The only thing I think we have is Horace Greeley, who saw a tremendous opportunity, you know, go west, young man, as a place for the nation to begin again. An idea, of course, taken up by Frederick Jackson Turner somewhat later. But in terms of the population boom, I don't think most Eastern Americans were aware of the population boom. They were much more interested in the economic boom and the idea of a new outpost on the Pacific Rim and all of that kind of thing. I think that's what captured their imaginations. The number of people congregating there, I'm just trying to think of all the things I've read, and I don't see that as being part of their consciousness.
Well, it appears that the questions this week are tougher than I thought they might be.
Yes.
Well, I'm so...
It's easier questions this week, but...
It just amazes me. A few months ago, I suggested that we consider the gold nugget as one of the artifacts for this topic. I had no idea it would produce such far-reaching interest. I was thinking many of these questions would relate to the mineralogy of it all. You know, how do we know it's gold, and what other sorts of gold do we have, and what is it about gold that makes it so valuable and scarce? Go ahead.
Anticipating that particular question. How do we know that it's gold?
Oh, no. Oh, no. You're kidding. Because we know. Because
well,
we know. Happily, we have at next door to my museum is the National Museum of Natural History, where the National Gem and Mineral Collection resides. They have very sophisticated machines that help break down each mineral, each gem in our collections to make sure it is what we think it is. So with great care, I carried our gold nugget from the California Gold Rush over to one of their fancy machines. I forget the name of it. It's more than a scanning electron microscope. And they took a non-destructive test of it and broke down all the chemical and mineralogical elemental ingredients of this little piece of gold and showed me just how much microscopic tin and mercury and silver and gold there is, and it's largely gold, pure, real gold, G-O-L-D.
Let's remind our listeners, how pure is it?
It's really pure. It's not 100% because of the impurities that are in most any raw metal, but it's well over 95%, throwing in some grit and gravel and a little bit of trace minerals and elements of silver and lead. A little bit, a touch of magnesium as well.
I see. Well, so I'm going to take it easy and give you guys a softball question now.
Wait a minute. This is the question I knew the answer to.
Oh, good. Let's hear it.
Well, there's a nice geology of gold, and gold is one of the few elements that appears in its pure form in nature, and it doesn't corrode. It can be amalgamated with certain things, but in the kind of gold we're talking about, not. Okay, so for example, when treasure hunters look for gold underwater, it's fairly easy to spot because salt doesn't corrode it. Silver, on the other hand, looks like a bunch of badly shaped rock. But gold is something that you can readily see. It's also very, very soft, so you always see in films people biting on a gold coin. Yes, that tends to work. It's tough on the teeth, but it does tend to work. And so with the geology of it comes from, you know, volcanic activity where these solutions containing gold are pushed to the surface and they separate in these fissures. Okay, and it's because of the processes, the heating and whatnot, the gold is reduced to its pure state. And it sits there inside these rock fissures for who knows how many million of years until erosion knocks it away. Now, I'm sure David has at the Smithsonian or across the street something called wire gold. And wire gold literally is the gold that has not been eroded and broken up so much by weather or water. And in any case, the gold is broken up. Pieces of it float downstream, lodge in bars. A whole lot of it lodged in a bar near Sutter's Mill, and you have the geology of gold.
Yes, as Paula said, the Smithsonian has many examples of gold from all parts of the world, especially the American West, large leaves of gold that were somehow extracted out of these seams and fissures intact before they broke up in many elaborate forms. Some look like flowers. It's quite a dramatic find. And as she also said, gold doesn't rust. It doesn't corrode, so it stays pure. All of our gold is bright yellow, just the way it was found hundreds of years ago.
It never even occurred to me that I guess I knew on some level that gold didn't tarnish or corrode, but it didn't occur to me that so many other things did. And Paula's example of looking for silver or gold underwater means that you probably wouldn't recognize, unless you knew what you were looking for, you wouldn't recognize silver, but likely would.
Well, you can look at
recognize gold.
You can look in a mountain stream or a stream that's near gold-bearing rocks, and on a good, bright, sunny day, providing it hasn't been mined out, you can see the gold in the stream bed. In fact, there are several tourist places in the American West to this day which give you a pan and give you a few rudimentary lessons in panning for gold and sit you down by a gold-bearing stream, and you can pan for gold and find real gold, because its specific gravity is such that it will fall to the bottom of your pan because it is so heavy. I mean, it's deceptively heavy. A small nugget in your hand will have a real heft to it.
Well, that actually may lead to the next question. Actually, this is our final question, which deals with perhaps mining the miners. And it seems like now as then, we may have an industry that's built up around mining miners. So we talked last time about the fact that certain businesses and industries arose in the West surrounding the miners themselves, servicing them and their needs. And maybe we could, for our final question, we could talk about what some of those common businesses would be. We know that they were successful, but maybe some of our listeners would like to know exactly what some of those businesses are. And I guess we could start with Paula and then finish with David.
Well, one of the first businesses, of course, that developed were the assaying businesses. And these were the businesses that had the skills to assay the gold. In other words, weigh it and test it for impurities, and then, you know, pay the miner and then take a cut and then arrange for shipping and whatnot. This is how people made their money, so they were there on the ground floor. Miners had to eat. So the freighters who brought the goods in and the mercantile groups that sold things were, of course, next in line to supply the miners with picks, shovels, the machinery, the rudimentary machinery of mining before placer mining was displaced. So I would say, just off the top of my head, those three, the assayers, the freighters bringing the... And sometimes the freighters and the mercantilists were one and the same. They'd bring it in, set up shop, and then sell out and head back down for another load. So I would say those three, just right off the top of my head. And then these would be followed by people who provided services. And here's where women, of course, got a toehold. David, can you add to that? Any folks that you...
Well, it's just one of the many fascinating stories of entrepreneurship in the 19th century. The gold rush, the California gold rush, provided a huge excuse for people to exercise their ingenuity. If not mining gold, then mining the miners. The rise of the shovel, the American shovel, gets a great boost by the California gold rush. I believe it was the Ames Shovel Company that really exploded with a whole variety of shovels. Clearly, how can you be a miner without a good shovel on your back? We all know the story of Levi Strauss, an immigrant Jew who did rather well converting sailcloth into durable pants. And today we know them as Levi's. Wheelbarrows were refined over time and fairly quickly in the period. Coincidentally and quite nicely, the California Gold Rush coincided with the fairly big explosion of mass-produced metalwares in the United States. The machinery was just coming online after developments earlier in the century to mass-produce things like sewing machine parts, farming machinery, and, of course, arms-making rifles and pistols. That knowledge, that know-how in metalworking spread gradually into making bicycles and small lamp parts. And certainly for the gold rush, a huge explosion of tools and devices used to mine gold. So it was a great fitting out of the country with machinery that the gold rush helped produce.
All right. Well, I had one final question just occurred to me when Paula was talking. How did the miners know how much to expect for their day's take in gold? They've mined X amount of ounces or grams of gold, and they go to the assayer to have it weighed and presumably to be paid for their gold. What is the value of that based on? Does it change every day? Do they have a pretty good notion of what a particular measure of gold is worth? David, do you want to start?
No, Paula, that's all yours. It's one of the quirky aspects of the gold rush that I don't think there was one set standard. Isn't that the case that people were hoping for the most, but I suspect acquired different opinions from different sources, or was there one single value assigned to gold?
Well, once again, it's the value that the assayer, if the gold was amalgamated with impurities, quartz, or something of this nature, then of course the value dropped. But here's what's sticking in my mind: by and large, now notice the emphasis on by and large, gold went for roughly $20 an ounce at the time. What does that mean? If we, generally speaking, multiply 22, multiply that 20 times 22, we'll get a sort of contemporary value. Okay, what's that?
Okay.
440,
right?
440. And that's pretty much, you know, gold is now selling for what, 620? It's also, you know, a market, hedge market against oil, but that's either here nor there. Mm-hmm. So, and $20 an ounce meant it was roughly a half month's pay for an artisanal worker. If you were a bricklayer or whatnot, you would earn between $45 and $60 a month. So that's pretty much what gold was worth. Now, there wasn't any way in which gold floated on the world market or was priced on the world market, because until the telegraph came, there was no way of getting those prices. So there was a sort of a time lag early on with communication about gold and mm-hmm. the price of gold. But if you're reading an account and you're trying to figure out what's going on economically, I think $20 an ounce wouldn't put you too far out of the ballpark.
Okay.
How does that sound?
Well, that's better than I thought. That's not a bad answer at all. Again, that predates the sort of day-to-day fluctuation, I would think. And they do the best they can with the technology and communication that they have.
Well we've been that being said, I mean, a ship would show up in San Francisco and announce that, you know, in the newspapers that gold was selling for X number of dollars or pounds sterling an ounce on the London Exchange or the New York Exchange, and then things would, you know, gone on. I do want to add one thing. There's
sure.
an old story that all the assayers, who later would, of course, become the early bankers, all were fond of having quite large beards. And so then they would assay some of the dust, the gold dust, would fall into the beard. And at the end of the day or however, you know, during whatever period they did, they would comb out their beard over a white sheet of paper and do a little gold dust recovery of their own.
Uh-huh.
Along with a little bit of dirt and tobacco juice and everything else in the beard.
Right, you know. egg crumbs, wow. Toast crumbs.
That's right. Fascinating. And James, just one other point, if I may. At least we believe that the gold rush started and stopped 150-some years ago. The gold rush, the idea of the gold rush continues to this day. Here we are in 2008. Gold remains an important mineral in our society and an important ingredient in the Silicon Valley, not too far from the gold rush fields themselves. Gold is a vital ingredient in microcircuitry, in silicon wafers, and inside people's computers, and I dare say inside cell phones and iPods. It continues to have that allure, and if you just look at Silicon Valley's economy and the wide-eyed wonder of bubble-bursting entrepreneurs down there, you get the same sense today of what the gold miners went through, heading for California, seeking riches, full of starry-eyed notions of what one's ideas and hard work might produce. So everyone listening should realize that it's not just California in the 1840s and 1850s. It's the gold rush, and gold rushes continue to this day.
That's a great way to end our program today. We want to thank Paula Petrick from the George Mason University and David Shait from the Smithsonian National Museum of American History. They've been participating in our online forum today. We want to thank callers as well for calling in with their questions, and we want to thank all of our participants. Join us next time as we choose another object from the Smithsonian's collection for the Object of History. It's been my pleasure to be your host today, and have a good day.
Bye-bye.
Well, thanks, guys.
Thank you, James, and thank you, Paula. I learned so much from you. We should get together sometime.
Yes, indeed. Okay,
right.
Bye, David. Bye, James.
All righty.
Bye. Thank you again.
Thank you, James.
Bye. Bye-bye.